Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
And you're back with Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And I invite you now to really sit down and listen carefully to our final conversation today, because we had a chance to sit down with a local revolutionary, Diane Paulus, artistic director of the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge. She's beloved by her fans and looked upon somewhat dubiously by some theater purists. All for the same reason, because here's a woman who looks anywhere and everywhere outside of traditional theater for inspiration. Case in point, the ART's latest show, set to come to life later this month. It's the world premiere of a musical version of Finding Neverland, based on the 2004 film starring Johnny Depp as the Peter Pan playwright J.M. Barrie. Here's a scene from the film.
When I think of your mother, I will always remember how happy she looked, sitting there in the parlor, watching a play about her family, about two boys that never grew up. She went to Neverland.
Now, it's no surprise at this point that the Tony Award-winning Paulus would want to take on a musical based on a film, based on a book, based on a writer. Because blowing open the doors of traditional theater, well, that's her professional life's mission.
I'm also looking for ways in which artists that are not in the theater can be brought into the theater. Like with Finding Neverland, the composers, Elliot Kennedy and Gary Barlow, British pop musicians who've never done a musical in their life, how can their sound and sensibility take a musical in a direction that maybe we've never heard before?
But after a piece has been through Paulus's hands, I'm going to guess you probably will have heard of folks like that, which is why Time magazine named Diane Paulus one of 2014's 100 most influential people in the world. And Tony Award-winning actor Audra McDonald, who's worked with Paulus, describes her as a director to whom nothing is sacred and everything is sacred. Well, we visited Diane Paulus in her office at ART earlier today, and we started by asking her a little bit more about the new Neverland musical. I've read that you said that you told your daughters that you were making Finding Neverland for them.
Yes, I have two beautiful young girls who are 7 and 10. I watched the movie with both of my daughters when I was thinking about taking on the show. And, you know, I turned to them, I'm like, what do you think, guys? I really, like, asked them, like, what do you think about this movie, this story? What about Peter Pan? I saw their eyes light up, and it's such a sensitive story about childhood and about growing up and about the role of the imagination in your life. I think it's giving me a special impulse in the rehearsal room and in the creative process to be thinking about them so specifically when I make the show. Even though they're four boys, they're like, when are you going to do a show with little girls, Mom? Pippin had a boy. They're like, when is the show with the little girls?
You know, I wanted to actually start off with something that we talked about 4 years ago now when you came in to visit us at WBUR. Because at that time, we spent a lot of time talking about your vision for what theater should be. And there was a moment where we were remembering what the theatrical experience was like for people in the original Globe Theater. And you had said that it was like a mosh pit. And that's an experience that you wanted to recreate for modern theater goers. Do you think you've been successful in doing that?
I feel theater has so many different forms. I would hate to think that I was someone, proselytizing for all theater to be like mosh pits. There is a time and a place for mosh pit theater. I just got so excited about theater as a visceral form that broke really architecture boundaries. You know, the idea of a mosh pit is that you're standing, your body's engaged, you're not in a seat that's bolted to the floor, that you're actually physically involved like you are at a rock concert. And as we know, Ground Lane stood at Shakespeare's Globe Theater.
Right.
Theater can look different ways. It can look like Sleep No More, an immersive adventure romp in an empty elementary school through 40 rooms of an immersive installation of Macbeth. It can also look like the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess in a proscenium stage where you sit in a chair. So my mission has been to say, let's not reduce theater to just one formula. Mm-hmm. Theater can look like many different things. And in that sense, you know, I hope I have pushed those boundaries for audiences here who have been so great in meeting us more than halfway on this adventure and ride and showing an openness to what theater can be.
Right. And a lot of people say that one of the things they love, you know, is that immersive experience, is that visceral experience. The word sensation, like satisfying the senses, comes up a lot, both positively, but also some people are a little more dubious about it. They think, you read that thing in the New York Times was saying that it satisfies sensation-hungry audiences today, the style right. that you're bringing to the theater.
I think I have always dreamed of a theater that satisfies heart, mind, body, soul, all of those. You know, that's great theater. This idea that you are coming together as a group, as an audience, and some kind of transformation happens. And I believe that transformation is most powerful when it's not just intellectual, when it hits your heartbeat and it makes your pulse race and you feel alive. And I just think in this day and age, we are at a time more than ever now where I feel so lucky to be in the theater. I'm not, you know, moaning that like theater's dead. I'm saying, no, we need the theater because we need people to feel present and alive in the moment. And that's what I think the theater can do as a medium. I love that you leave the theater with questions, that, you know, you might have a visceral physical experience, emotional experience, like you have with music, you know, and rhythm that just enters your body and you can't understand it, but it affects you, whether you're laughing or crying or feeling something. And then to me, the theater experience continues after the event, where you process it, where you want to talk about it, when you want to think about it. To me, that's what I hope I can create as an artist.
Is that your response to when people say it's too sensation driven, that there is that sort of intellectual part that people take with them after the performance?
I'm so happy that people think it's too sensation driven. No, I mean, I'm happy to hear that people feel their senses engaged, because I'm really a believer in that. But I just want to say that I feel there is always, you know, a human need to learn. I mean, I believe in that. We want to be challenged. We want to engage our minds. We want to, you know, search for the unknown and understand things and identify with points of view that are different from our own and wrestle with that.
You know, I had mentioned the New York Times review. Do you even read reviews of the shows?
I actually read all the reviews.
You do?
I do. I have pretty tough skin, and I think every artist has their different, you know, mode of operation. I know some people, especially actors, tend not to read reviews because they're so in the process. But as a director, you are really standing on the outside, continually trying to wash your eyes clean and look at it fresh. Look at it fresh. When the reviews hit, mainly they become useful when you have another shot at the show. You know, let's say the show's going to have a future life. Then it's always interesting to look at the reviews and say, well, what did this person get or not get? And why is that? And for sure, reviews can be guides in terms of dictating some changes as to, you know, where you might want to fine tune things or take a different approach. So, yeah. I usually take every single review when I've done a show, and I get my, you know, little inner team, and we go, you know, write lists of everything everybody's ever said. And we got to collate them to see if people are all talking about the same thing, you know, both positive and negative. So you kind of create your own inner statistics analysis of the reviews you get.
I'm impressed. I have to say, I didn't expect that answer at all. But like you said, maybe you've got thick, you've got tough skin.
Yeah. And, you know, theater is hard, and it's hard to make great work. And when a reviewer can help you see something, that's really a gift.
So you said that one of the reasons why it's useful to you to look at reviews is if the show has a future life. And so a lot of the shows that have begun here have had or are having their next lives in New York.
Right.
Porgy, definitely.
Yes.
All the Way.
Right. Pippin.
Pippin,
of course. From last year.
Pippin from last year. Once,
yes. Sleep No More.
Sleep No More.
Still running in New York.
There's quite a few. do you see that as a sign of the success or your success at ART?
You know, everything we do at ART is about expanding the boundaries of theater for our audiences here. And what happens when that work goes well is there is an opportunity to do it again. So I find this track record we've had of shows moving to New York and having additional runs is a tribute to the work the artists have done here at the theater in terms of their incubation here and really working out great, excellent theater here in Boston. I mean, that's the story. And audiences in New York, which, you know, makes me so happy, are talking about Boston and the theater that is being created here in ART as the incubator for the best theater in the country.
But I also find that it's so Boston to both want that and be successful at that, and yet at the same time be kind of grouchy about it as well. Because, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Like, there was this recent article in Boston Magazine that quoted a lot of people saying that they're concerned that ART has basically become a factory for Broadway productions.
Right.
And they're not happy about it.
I think you could look at our track record and say, wow, we've become a factory, but it's not our intention. I think it's, a remarkable track record. And I always tell my board, it's not always like this. It's not that every show goes to Broadway. Trust me, it is very hard to do good work. What is great about having been given this opportunity to transfer shows is the awareness of the theater is on a whole other level now. There are artists all over the country and the world who want to come to Boston to be part of the theater here. I mean, let's take Bryan Cranston. He was at the top of his game, right? The final season, Breaking Bad, he was on 60 Minutes, the cover of GQ, you name it, he was there. What did he want to do? Roll up his sleeves, come and live here in Cambridge and do All the Way. Zach Quinno has loved Tennessee Williams. Yes, he's Spock, but he loves Tennessee Williams. And it was his dream to work on a Tennessee Williams play in an environment like we have here at ART. So I just think we have a profile now where we can do work with really incredible artists and foster this community with our audience here in Boston and Cambridge. This audience here helps us hear the plays, helps us develop the work. It's that partnership that I think is so exciting and fulfilling right now.
Well, we're speaking with Diane Paulus in her office at the Loeb Drama Center at the ART. So people who know your story, professional background, will know this story, but I just love it. So I'm going to ask you to tell it again. And I wonder if it's here.
The Endgame poster.
The Endgame poster. Is it here?
It is. It's right over there. Where? On the wall, you'll see Samuel Beckett sitting kind of like in that garbage heap.
Yeah.
Which was the set for Endgame. It's right over there.
Oh, there it is.
Yes.
Okay.
So that, I was a student at Harvard University in the 80s. And of course, I loved the theater as a high schooler. And I came to Harvard and I thought I was going to major in government and be a politician. But what did I do? I was hanging out at the ART, haunting the hallways, second act crashing, ushering for shows, dragging all my college mates who wanted to go into finance. I was like, you have to come see this Robert Wilson play. Trust me, it will blow your mind. And that I did see that production of Endgame that was kind of an iconic production here.
And you stole the poster.
I stole the poster. I framed it, with a plastic frame from the coop and stuck it in my dorm room as a sophomore. And when I got the job here, I pulled it out. I was like, this is coming back with me to my office at the ART.
So the reason why I wanted to ask you about that is that apparently it was that production of Endgame that really riled up Beckett. Right?
Yes.
Because ART decided to basically set it in a old subway station.
Yeah, like a subway.
Yeah, bombed out subway station. Right. And Beckett said he demanded that a statement from him be printed in the program.
Yeah.
Right. And so Boston Magazine has actually dug out what that statement was. And it read in part, "My play requires an empty room and two small windows. The American Repertory Theater production, which dismisses my directions, is a complete parody of the play as conceived by me. Anybody who cares for the work couldn't fail to be disgusted by this." Well, first of all, clearly you didn't feel that way.
I didn't feel it's indelibly like marked in my brain as a 19-year-old when I saw it. When I was a student here, that's what you got at the ART. You saw productions that literally felt like a wedge had been stuck in your brain in terms of what theater could be. These reinterpretations of the classics like Endgame, incredible new work being premiered by Robert Wilson, Philip Glass, things that I'd never seen on the stage before. Such that when I left Harvard and I went to New York and I was, starting out my career as an actor, you know, that was the ultimate, not to be an actor and get a TV or a movie. It was like to come back to the ART because that was the best theater in America. Just what the work that was being done here for all of us as young artists, set designers, aspiring actors, directors, the ART was this beacon of what was possible in the American theater.
Yeah. I mean, that's why it seems so interesting to me now that while there's this concurrent surge in popularity with the productions you've brought here, there's also this sort of stalwart set of critics who say, this isn't necessarily what the ART should be all about. Because I look at Samuel Beckett basically saying the same thing in 1984. So, I mean, is that part of the constant tension that any experimental theater is going to have?
You know, we have a trustee on our board now, and he's been around the ART the entire time. He actually saw shows that Brustein did at Yale Rep before he came to Harvard. And he said something to me, this is now almost 5 years ago. He said, you know, you're doing what Bob did in his early days. You're taking theater and growing it and expanding it and showing us things that we didn't think were possible. So, you know, he said, I see you in a line in terms of the history of the theater, you know, not repeating itself, but actually taking that rebellious spirit that came to Cambridge back in 79-80 when Bob got here, you know, who's a huge mentor of mine. The theater is changing with the world, and we need to change. I mean, that's our mission, right? To reflect the world we live in. So how can we do that? And that's not just about form, but it's also about culture mm-hmm. and how we receive culture and how we think about audience and how we think about art in our life.
And I have to say, I just love the fact that the piece of theater that inspired you is the one that infuriated Samuel Beckett. I just kind of love that.
Yes.
Actually, this leads me to like a very simple question, which I'm surprised that maybe we didn't talk about before, but how do you decide what shows to put on here?
It's a great question. I tend to think about both artists and subject matter that I feel will catalyze the biggest discussion around a given show. So it's thinking about artists that are tackling subject matters like Eve Ensler, who's coming next season to do OPC, a play about obsessive political correctness and the planet and the environment. And I gravitate to those people because I know that their work will create opportunities here at ART for community building around issues. How can we push the theater to be beyond what we know it to be?
Diane, you are so charismatic and passionate, and I don't know if this is the right phrase, but almost evangelical about the purpose of theater in modern life. I'm hoping you'd be also totally honest with me and tell me what's been your toughest moment here.
You know, I don't think there's been one tough moment. There have been many. The thing that's hard in the theater is you always have to start again. You know, every show you do, you're climbing a mountain. And then it's not like, okay, we're on the top of the mountain. Let's just camp out here. You've got to, like, start again. And starting again with every show, it's just endurance, I think. It's like it's developing an inner reserve of endurance. And I think what's been great now is the staff and the administration and the people who are part of our company here at ART, I think, are so engaged in the work we're doing so that we've all learned as a company, you know, like what to pack on the hike so we can be even more prepared when we climb that next mountain.
Finally, it's energizing to hear your restless creativity. But I suppose that, like, your fans also out there worry that that restlessness will eventually take you away from the ART. You just signed another 5-year contract, so we've got 5 more years. But do you ever feel that pull?
I have had such an incredible experience over the last 5 years here that it was no question in my mind to sign on and do another 5 here. I mean, to have the theater at its current kind of place of vibrations in the building and to just take that now into future planning was like an opportunity that in the early years I didn't have because it was like, what's next month? You know, what's 6 months away? We are now in a position at the theater where we are really planning 2 to 3 to 4 years in advance, which translates into really exciting development and even more work, by the way. It's not like you get the work done. No, actually, you're taking on more in the present moment. you know, but for me, I think I strive to live in the present as a theater artist. So I'm very much in the present at this moment, which for me is feeling extremely grateful to have this home here in Boston at the ART.
Skillful answer. Well, Diane Paulus, it is always such a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, so much. And here's to another great 5 years, at least.
Yes, at least. Here, here. Thank you.
Diane Paulus is the artistic director at the ART. We spoke to her in her office at the Loeb Drama Center in Cambridge. And Paulus's latest project is a musical version of Finding Neverland. It opens later this month. There's more information at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Join us tomorrow for more Radio Boston.